Let's open up our Bibles back to 1 Kings chapter 16, what Wade read for us. 1 Kings chapter 16. Hope everyone had a good afternoon and a good Mother's Day. We're going to be talking tonight about Ahab and Jezebel. And if you remember back to our gospel meeting about a month or so ago, we had a lesson on Ahab and Jezebel. This evening we're going to take a little bit different direction and focus on something else in their lives than what we focused on in the gospel meeting. When you think about Ahab and Jezebel, no two people in the Bible were as notoriously evil as they were. I mean, just think about it. Have you ever met someone that was named Ahab or Jezebel? If you have, then that's fine, but I've never met anyone named Ahab or Jezebel. And when you read characters in literature that are named Ahab, like the Ahab, if you ever read the book Moby Dick, he's the kind of crazed captain of the ship who's going after the whale. He's not really that bright of a character either. And so the names themselves even carry the notoriously evil character that they had. When we last studied from the Kings a couple weeks ago, I showed you this chart which shows the highlights, or not really highlights per se, of Israel, the northern kingdom. These are the economic, the political highlights. You might remember that Israel, the northern kingdom, really had no religious highlights. Everything was just downhill from the divided kingdom onward. They just continually stopped serving God. But if you notice, the first hump there indicates the prosperity that Omri and his son Ahab enjoyed. There were two battles, at least during Ahab's life, where he had victory. God blessed him with military victory over the kingdom of Aram. So God was with Ahab, at least for a time militarily. But consistently, you see him turning away from God. So this evening, we're going to be thinking about Ahab. And let's just begin by just getting a kind of a summary of his life based upon what we read a few moments ago. Verse 29 tells us that he reigned 22 years over Israel. And throughout this text here, 1 Kings chapter 16, God does not hesitate to comment on Ahab's character. You know, there are some people in the Bible where they'll do something and you can kind of conclude that it was the wrong thing to do, but the Bible doesn't really come out right out and say this was a wrong thing to do, or come right out and say God was displeased with that. But God did not hesitate to speak his mind about Ahab. So beginning in verse 30, it says, Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who went before him. More than all who went before him. Ahab was worse than all the kings who came before him. For one thing, in verse 31, he followed the idolatry of Jeroboam. Remember, that was the point at which the kingdom divided. Jeroboam sent up two golden calves, one at Dan, one at Bethel. And he said, these are your gods. And of course, he established a new religious system for people to worship so they didn't have to go to Jerusalem. And so Ahab just continues that line. But notice, that's just the beginning of this. It says, as if it had been a trivial thing for him to follow Jeroboam, he married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went to serve Baal and worshipped him. Now think about what that says about Jezebel. God says of Ahab, if it was just a little thing for him to follow in Jeroboam's idolatry, he went over there and he married Jezebel. That should tell us something right off the bat about the kind of woman Jezebel was. I mean, the kind of woman that Jezebel was, we're going to see, and we know, she was one of the most evil, conniving people in all of the Bible. And Ahab married her. And he didn't even look past, he didn't even think about the kind of influence that she would be on him. This is a statement not only of Jezebel's character, but of Ahab's character, because he was attached to her. But Jezebel brought him to worship Baal. And maybe that's the one thing that this text points out, is that it was because of Jezebel that he followed the Baals. Verse 31, he went to serve Baal and worshiped him. In fact, we're going to see tonight that Israel had previously worshipped Baal in other periods in their history. But this is the first time that a king of Israel is adopting Baal worship as the official religion of the people. This is the first time that the people begin to worship these gods, these Baals, in the kingdom period. Verse 32, he doesn't just worship the Baals, but he erected an altar to Baal and the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. He's not just a little bit reverent to Baal, but he's so reverent that he builds a house, a temple, and an altar to Baal. Not only that, in verse 33, he built the Asherah, or the wooden image. The Asherah here is another Canaanite god, and she's a female goddess. And so he's worshiping the Asherah. And so it says in verse 33, Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel than all the kings of Israel who were before him. Again, you see that statement there. He is the worst king up to this point of the northern kingdom. But then in verse 34, we have this interesting statement about Hiel the Bethelite building Jericho, or rebuilding Jericho. You might remember that whenever the people came into the land of Canaan for the first time, the first city that they conquered was Jericho. And God put a ban on that city after it was destroyed and said, you are not to take any of the spoils to yourselves. You're to completely destroy it. And he put a curse on it. And he said, whoever rebuilds this city will do so with the death of his firstborn and his last son. And Ahab seems like, in connection with what we just read, this is kind of also a statement of Ahab's character. It was he who commissioned the rebuilding of Jericho, despite the fact that God had put a curse on the city. And if you think about this, the destruction of Jericho was kind of a symbol of how the people were faithfully going to conquer the land. But now that the city is being rebuilt, this is a symbol of how they are rebuilding the nation, the land of Canaan, as it once was. This is exactly what's happening in the days of Ahab. The land of Canaan is becoming exactly the way it used to be in the idolatry and the immorality that they should have driven out. And so 1 Kings chapter 21 makes this statement to summarize Ahab's life and his reign. 1 Kings chapter 21, verse 25. Surely there was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the sight of the Lord because Jezebel, his wife, incited him. He acted very abominably in following idols according to all that the Amorites had done, whom the Lord cast out before the sons of Israel. Once again, I want you to notice that God does not hesitate to comment on Ahab's character. He's characterized by unrestrained selfishness, idolatry, and godless rebellion before the God that he should have served. Tonight, I want us to focus on one particular aspect of Ahab's reign, and that is that he brought in the Baal worship. In 1 Kings chapter 17 through 18, you see the story unfolding of God versus Baal. And we're going to meet a prophet named Elijah. And this is kind of the story of Ahab's life. Who's really in control? Is it God or is it Baal? And you see this conflict between Elijah and Ahab coming up so often. You remember that once Elijah came to him and Ahab saw him and he said, look at you, you troubler of Israel. And Elijah responded, no, I'm not the one who's brought trouble on Israel. It's you and your family because you've started to worship these gods and you've led Israel down this road. You see this conflict between Elijah and Ahab all throughout Ahab's life, but it's not really a conflict between the king and the prophet. It's ultimately a conflict between God or Baal. Who is really the true God? So let's understand a couple things about Baal, first of all. Baal was the Canaanite god of the storm, along with that, rain and fire, and the god of fertility. And so you see Baal worship involved in a lot of rituals where they're calling down rain from heaven, or where they're calling for a good harvest, or even immorality. All kinds of things involved in Baal worship. And he's often called, in ancient texts that talk about Baal, in Canaanite texts, he's called the rider of the clouds. They viewed him as the one in charge of the storms. If there was a storm that came up, it was Baal who was bringing that storm. Keep that in mind because we'll come back to that. And we notice that that Israel had worshipped Baal in other times in their history. For example, in Numbers chapter 25, when the people are still in the wilderness, they're still wandering, and they came up beside the nation of Moab, and they begin to be involved in the immorality and the idolatry that the nation of Moab. And it did not go well for them. Nor did it go well for them in the time of Judges, when in Judges chapter 2, verses 11 through 13, they again begin to follow the Baals. And they follow the Baals, and their harvest disappears. And other nations come in, and they destroy their land. It never ends well for them when they follow the Baals or other gods. But then they begin to follow this Baal. Again, Ahab is the first king to introduce Baal worship in the kingdom period. But this story tells us that Baal is not the one who's really in control, but instead it's God. Let me point you to a couple things that illustrates this. First of all, in 1 Kings chapter 17, in verse 1, this is the first time that we meet Elijah the prophet. It says, "Now Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the sellers of Gilead, said to Ahab, 'As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, surely there shall neither be dew nor rain these years except by my word.'" So Elijah, when we first meet him, he's standing up to Ahab and he says, there's going to be drought. Not a drop of water, not a drop of water from the sky, not a drop of dew on the ground. There's going to be not a drop of water for three years, ultimately, because of Elijah's word. And notice that Elijah here is a prophet of God. He's not a prophet of Baal. And so God is showing, Elijah is showing Ahab that it is God who controls the land's productivity. The people viewed Baal as the one who is in control of the fertile land, and it's he who's in control of the rain and the storms. But Elijah points out it is not Baal, but it is God who is in control of that. When we come to 1 Kings chapter 18, we have this famous story of the showdown at Carmel, where Elijah comes to Ahab, and he says in verse 19, 1 Kings chapter 18, "Now send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel. Gather the 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of the Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." And so all the people gather together, and Elijah tells them, "Look, you build an altar for Baal. And you put an animal on the altar and you pray for Baal to send fire." And so they did. They prayed all day. They cried out to Baal all day, all afternoon. And it says in verse 26, "Then they put the ox which was given them, and they prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, 'O Baal, answer us.' But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they leaped about the altar which they made. It came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, 'Call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he is occupied or gone aside, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he is sleeping and needs to be awakened.'" You hear his sarcasm there. Maybe your god is sleeping. And if your god is sleeping, what good can he do to you? If your god is on a journey, what good can he do to you? Think about the contrast there between Baal and God, the true God who never sleeps, who never goes away, but is always in tune to our needs. But in verse 28, they cried out with a loud voice and cut themselves according to their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out on them. When midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice, no one answered, and no one paid attention. But in verse 30, Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." So all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord has come, saying, "Israel shall be your name." So with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar, large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood and cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill four pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. They did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar and also filled the trench with water. So 12 pitchers full of water had soaked the altar, soaked the wood, and soaked the sacrifice. And then Elijah prays. In verse 37, he says, answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their heart back again. Then fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. When all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, the Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. Now remember, the people viewed Baal as the god of lightning. They viewed him as the god of thunder and of fire. But it is not Baal who answers the people. It is God who answers Elijah. It is God who controls fire. It is God who controls the lightning. And one other thing to insert here, it was on Mount Carmel that apparently the prophets of Baal worshipped Baal. And so clearly God is defeating Baal on his own turf. Notice what Elijah does here. He even gives the prophets of Baal home field advantage. And he says, look, we'll do this showdown in his home turf. And it is there that God brings fire and demonstrates that he is the true God. And then after that, in 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 41, it says, now Elijah said to Ahab, go up, eat and drink, for there is the sound of the roar of a heavy shower. So Ahab went up to eat and drink, but Elijah went up to the top of Mount Carmel, and he crouched down on the earth and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, go up now, look toward the sea. So he went up and looked and said, there is nothing. And he said, go back seven times. It came about at the seventh time that he said, behold, a cloud as small as a man's hand is coming up from the sea. And he said, go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down so that the heavy shower does not stop you. In a little while, the sky grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy shower, and Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. It is God who brings the rain, not Baal who brings the rain. God controls the land's productivity. God controls fire and lightning. God controls the storm. And the simple point is this, that God is the one true God that we need to serve. And that was the whole point of this showdown. Elijah prayed to God that he would bring fire and demonstrate that he is the one true God so that the people's hearts will turn back to God again. That was what Elijah's work and prophecy was all about. No idol can compare to God. And that's what I want us to think about in Ahab's life. You know, when we think about idolatry today, we often don't think of it as something that we might struggle with. I don't know about you, but there is nothing about building a statue out of wood or metal and falling down and worshiping it that appeals to me. There's just nothing that seems right about that. It's illogical. There's nothing that makes sense about that. But because of that, sometimes we think that, well, I just don't struggle with idolatry. It's not really that big of a deal for us today. We need to understand that it is rampant in Israel's history. Remember, one of the first commandments God gave to them was, you shall have no other God before me. And the second command was related to that. You shall not build a graven image of me. It wasn't just a matter of building a graven image of another god, but even building a graven image to replicate what God might look like was forbidden, because God cannot be replicated. God cannot be reduced down to a physical form because he is God. But despite that, the people persisted time and time again in following after other gods, beginning even as far back as Abraham and Abraham's fathers. Joshua chapter 24, this famous passage where Joshua is challenging the people to lay aside their other gods and choose whom they will serve. And he says to them, if it is verse 14, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. There he's speaking about Abraham and Abraham's fathers beyond the river Euphrates, how they served other gods. And so he says to them, if it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And of course, the people agreed. Yeah, we're going to serve the Lord. And he challenges them. No, you're not going to be able to serve the Lord because he's a jealous God. He doesn't want you to serve him and other gods. He wants you to serve him alone, exclusively. And when you read the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, and the minor prophets, time and time again, just about every prophet that was recorded for us denounced the people's idolatry in some way, because idolatry was rampant in Old Testament history. But it's not just something that characterized God's people, it's something that actually characterizes global history. If you just think about the times when you've read or studied in school history and the kind of religions that people have traditionally followed, time and time again, people have followed other gods and built gods to worship. I found this quote from Wikipedia to illustrate. In the traditional religions of ancient Greece, or Egypt, Greece, Rome, Africa, Asia, the Americas, and elsewhere, the reverence of an image or statue has been a common practice, and cult images have carried different meanings and significance. If you think about that statement now, just about every ancient culture that you can think of had some form of religion in which they worshipped a god. Now, again, on different levels. This doesn't mean that every single culture has worshipped in idols. But by and large, just about every religion or every culture that you can think of has some form of a visible god that they worship. And I ask myself this question, why is that the case? First of all, I think it's notable to think and note that just about every culture is religious. In our culture today, we're becoming more secular and less religious. And that's something that's relatively new. But just about every culture in ancient times you can think of is religious in some way. And I think that speaks to the need that we have built in us to worship something. But why is idolatry so common in global human history? Why is it that we can study so many ancient cultures, the Aztecs, the Greeks, or the Grecians, the Romans, Africans, and even in our own country's history, there is idolatry? Why is that? Is it because that speaks to a common desire within us as humans? And it raises this question, are we so immune to idolatry as we often think we are? If human nature is characterized by and large by serving idols, what about us? You know, we think that serving idols is kind of a barbaric thing to do. In our modern culture, we think, well, that's just for backwoods cultures. But you know what? Idolatry comes in a lot of different forms. Colossians chapter 3, verse 5 speaks to this. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. Paul tells us, therefore, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry. Or another translation says, which is idolatry. Now think about that statement for a moment. He is not talking about the form of idolatry that we often think of building an image and falling down before it and worshiping it. Rather, he's talking about attitudes that are invisible in our hearts, that comes out in our actions. Idolatry manifests itself in a lot more ways than just visible idolatry. This passage tells us that the same thing that resided in Ahab that led him to follow Baal resides within us that can lead us away from God. Not necessarily to worship Baal or another physical idol, but to worship one of these things that he's mentioned here. Immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which he says is idolatry. And by the way, let's identify what an idol is. An idol has often been defined as something that takes the place of God. And I think that's a fair enough description as far as it goes. But here's what I think is a better description of an idol. An idol is anything that competes with God for first place in our life. Anything that competes with God for your total, absolute, exclusive allegiance. Someone might say, well, I'm serving God, but I'm also serving money. Or I'm serving God, but I'm also serving Baal. God would tell you, Elijah would tell you, you can't do that. If you try to serve God and anything else at the same time, as if they're equals, you have fallen into idolatry. The point is that if we're going to serve God and Him alone, then we're going to have to give Him our total, absolute allegiance. Otherwise, we're characterized as idolaters. So let's think about four warnings, or we might say lessons, on idolatry from Ahab and Jezebel's life. So let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 16 for a moment. 1 Kings chapter 16, and as we go through these lessons, think about things that might try to compete with your allegiance for God. Things that might become idols for you, and apply these lessons. The first lesson we take is that idolatry angers God, that it is an abomination to Him. 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 33. Ahab also made the Asherah. Thus Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel than all the kings of Israel who were before him. Ahab provoked the Lord. Not because the Lord is some capricious, whimsical, unpredictable God that we just have to please and we don't ever know what's making him happy. That's not the kind of God we serve. But rather we serve a jealous God. A jealous God who made us, who built us, and put a soul within us. And because He is our Creator, He expects our soul in exclusive devotion to God. As the greatest command says, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your soul, with all of your might, with all of your strength. And so we think about idolatry angering God, certainly in the Old Testament. But what about the idolatry of our hearts? What about things that compete for our allegiance to God? Those things anger God just as much. Go back to Colossians chapter 3 and verse 6 now. Right after Paul identifies the idols that we can worship today, he says in verse 6, "For it is because of these things that the wrath of God will come upon the sons of disobedience." If we find ourselves idolaters of passion, money, possessions, whatever it is, we are in grave danger of experiencing God's wrath. And by the way, the point that he makes here is that we were once in that boat. Verse 7, we also once walked when you were living in them. This isn't just something that we've never done, but all of us have been idolaters at some point in our lives before we gave our lives to Christ. Grave danger we are in when we serve other gods. Secondly, idolatry creates apathy toward God. Idolatry makes us kind of lukewarm about God. In the showdown on Mount Carmel that Elijah organizes in 1 Kings chapter 18, beginning in verse 20, it says, "So Ahab sent a message among all the sons of Israel and brought together the prophets at Mount Carmel. Elijah came near to all the people and said, 'How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, or if Yahweh is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him.' But the people did not answer him a word." Now that to me is striking. These people ought to know better, shouldn't they? But when Elijah presents them with this challenge, like Joshua presented the people with the challenge, choose whom you're going to serve, the people did not say a single thing. There was not a single person, not a single man, not a single woman, not a single child who stood up and said, "We know that God is the true God." because they were steeped in this mindset that we can serve Baal and we can serve God at the same time. Best of both worlds. They didn't think of it in the sense that Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6, you can't serve God and wealth. You can't serve two masters at the same time. Either you're going to love one or you're going to hate the other. We can't have the best of both worlds. Stop riding the fence, Elijah is saying to them. And so we need to understand that if we find ourselves falling into this kind of heart idolatry, that ultimately it's going to lead us down the same road. It's going to lead us to feel apathetic towards God. You know, we might not, you know, think, well, I'm just going to give up God entirely, but we're not as zealous as we need to be. We lose our passion for the Lord because the weeds of life have overcrowded the spiritual fruit that we ought to bear. We can suffer likewise from indifference and apathy because of the idols in our lives. Another lesson that we can take from this showdown in 1 Kings chapter 18 is that idols simply can't do anything for you. The people cried out to Baal, and they didn't even stop at that, but they cut themselves. They thought that the more harm that they did to their physical bodies, the more Baal is likely to listen, but nothing happened. There was no one that answered. Not a single drop of rain came from the sky, not a single lightning strike. Idols can do nothing for you. Sure, they might provide us some emotional satisfaction, some emotional high, like the people were just on emotional high when they were leaping about the altar, but they can't give you anything that lasts or that really matters. They can't give you wealth. They can't give you power. They can't give you good looks, because those things ultimately cannot save you in the end. But think about God's power, on the other hand. Idols can't do a single thing for you. But what did God do for Elijah? How many prayers did it take for Elijah to pray for fire to come down and God answered? It only took one. He prayed one time and lightning came down. And here's a lesson for us. Very quickly, in the book of James chapter 5, James points us back to one of these stories that we've mentioned about how Elijah prayed for rain. He prayed for drought first, then he prayed for rain. And in James chapter 5, verse 16, at the end of the verse, it says, the effective prayer of a righteous man can accomplish much. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the earth for 3 years and 6 months. Then he prayed again, and the sky poured rain, and the earth, it produced its fruits. Idols can't answer your prayers. Wealth can't answer your prayers. Good looks can't answer your prayers. They're not going to be able to satisfy you. They're not going to really give you what you're truly seeking. But God can give you what really matters. God can answer our prayer. And then finally, when we are confronted with our idols, like Ahab was and like Jezebel was, they're extremely hard to tear down. Remember how Jezebel reacted to the showdown at Mount Carmel? Going back to 1 Kings chapter 19, she didn't humble herself before God, but rather it says in verse 1, now Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, so may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. That's a death threat there. She says to him, if you don't get out of town now, I'm going to cut your head off. Instead of observing the truth of what has just happened, instead of observing that the prophets of Baal did nothing, and that it was God who brought the lightning strike from the fire from heaven, it is God who is the true God, she refused to believe that. Instead, she refused to tear down her idols. And here's a lesson for us, that once we get attached to our idols, once we invest in them, they're extremely hard to tear down. Because we attach our life to them, we attach our happiness to our idols, we tend to justify and protect and defend our idols. Instead of listening to God, we justify ourselves and we say things like, well, they make me happy. God wants me to be happy, right? Or might say things like, well, they're not that bad. They're not inherently wrong. And so it's not too wrong to view this as an idol or worship this as an idol. Idols are extremely difficult to tear down. And that's where humility comes in. And that's where we need to be honest with ourselves and ask ourselves, what are the Baals of my life? I don't know about you, but these are very, very hard to pinpoint. This is a challenging lesson for me because this challenges me to look at my life and say, what are the things that take away my zeal from God? What are the things that suck the life, the spiritual life out of me? What are the things that I struggle with in my life? And those things need to be torn down. Again, these are challenging things, but these are things that need to be torn down in our lives. We might think of several. You can probably think of more than this. But the obvious one, of course, is money. Are we serving money or material possessions? Paul says that greed amounts to idolatry. Or maybe it's something like sexual pleasure. In that passage in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, he mentions other things like immorality, impurity, passion. Those are things which can be described as things which are illicit sexual pleasures. Sexual pleasure can be an idol that we need to tear down. Or maybe it's something like knowledge or education. Maybe it's, you know, I want to be the most knowledgeable person in the world, or I want to be the most educated. Maybe we worship that idea. Or maybe it's power or prestige or having influence over people. Being able to command people or tell people what they need to do. Maybe it's the way we look, our appearance, that we spend so much time focusing on that that it takes us away from what is most important and the appearance that we ought to be cultivating inside. Or maybe it's something like science or philosophy. Now, science, I think, is slowly taking the place of God in our culture. Instead of believing that God created the world, we're just subjecting it to natural processes. And maybe putting too much stock in what our minds tell us. And maybe it's something like relationships, family, or friends. Maybe we put them before God, or maybe they compete with God for all our ultimate allegiance that ought to go to Him. Now notice that none of these things are inherently wrong. In fact, God created every single one of these things, didn't He? He created money. He created the sexual desire. He created knowledge, and He gives us the ability to know things. He created the ability for people to exercise authority. He created people who are beautiful. He created our looks and for us to desire beautiful things. He created the world with all its laws for us to observe and study and to study science. He created our minds to reason through philosophy. He created our relationships, our families, our friends, the church itself. Every single one of these things are good and can be used for good. But we need to understand that these things can compete with God for first place in our lives. And if they are, we need to tear them down, lest we become like Ahab. And as we close tonight, I want you to notice what Ahab does in 1 Kings chapter 21. And to me, this is one of the most powerful things in the story of Ahab. Elijah comes to Ahab and he rebukes him after he has taken Naboth's vineyard, after that despicable plot that Jezebel comes up with. And it says in verse 21, in response to Elijah's words, it came about when Ahab heard these words that he tore his clothes and he put on sackcloth and fasted, and he lay in sackcloth and went about despondently. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Do you see how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but I will bring the evil upon his house in his son's days." You know, this is not something we think about in connection with Ahab very often. We often focus on his idolatry and his Baal worship and his immorality. And by all means, that's what God focuses on whenever God speaks of him most frequently in the book of 1 Kings. But at least in one point in his life, he humbled himself before God. Now, it doesn't necessarily say that he repented of his idols and he turned and served God with the rest of his life. Indication is he didn't do that, but he did humble himself. And the thing that stands out to me about that is a man who is so hardened, a man who is so blind by his idols, even he was touched by the lesson that Elijah told him. What about us? Are we humbled? When we find that there are idols in our lives, that there are Baals, do we humble ourselves before the Lord? If we do, then the Lord will recognize the humility of our hearts. And we need to even go even further than Ahab did. Indication is Ahab continued to follow the Baals and listen to the prophets of Baal. But us, we need to go a step further. And because of that humility, serve God and Him alone. Where's your faith tonight? Is your faith singly focused on God and Him alone? If it's not, hope this lesson challenges you as it has challenged me tonight. If you're subject to the Lord's invitation to make your life right before God, here's a time for you to do it. So please come to the front as we stand and sing to encourage you.